Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bedlam. An institution with so striking an atmosphere that an entire state of chaos was named after it. Ask anybody what they think they know about Bedlam, and the first thing they'll say is, oh, well, it's an asylum. With a little bit of nudging, they might think of tourists going to laugh at the mad people. And I use the word mad in the context of those 18th century tourists. Mental health is one of those areas in which society has had to rapidly revise and update its ideas. There's still a long way to go. Bedlam itself, which I was surprised to discover still exists and is still giving mental health care, is unveiling an overhaul in its image and facilities. It's not called Bedlam, it's called Bethlehem. And that cast iron fact about it being an asylum? Not so cast iron. In fact, not true at all. So with 320 beds spread across 20 or so wards, what is Bethlehem now? It's Saturday the 21st of February 2015. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. This is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, stood out me, see me to the air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam rag store.
My heart aches for some fire.
Well, hello, hello. We've come to South East London. It feels like we've gone beyond South East London, actually. There's greenery in abundance, and there are semi-detached cottages with their own parking spaces, which tells you all you need to know. I've just got off the train at Eden Park and headed down to a place that I've heard a lot about. It's the Bethlehem Hospital. It's a psychiatric hospital, and it's got a lot of history attached to it. With me at the moment, two figures, which are melancholy and raving. But that is not my two guests today, who are respectively Richard Morley, who is the Senior Communications and Media Officer, and Victoria Northwood, who is the Head of Archives and Museums here at Bethlehem. Hello.
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 I mean, this, in a way, this is a perfect episode for radio, because we're going to be doing a lot of imagining today. The place is being renovated at the moment. It's in the midst of a refit. You'll be hearing, listener, booted feet going up and down the stairs as building works are carried out. How far through the renovation project are we?
Well, we're nearly complete now. The building was originally designed as office space, so we've been removing a lot of internal walls within the building to create the spaces we need for storing the collections and creating gallery spaces. So that work's all been done, and really we are getting towards the end of the fit out. So we have a permanent exhibition which is just being completed, and we should be hanging some paintings and putting some objects in next week. The rest is just the sort of final touches of paintwork, really. So there's a lot of activity going on, but we're very close to the end now, which is really exciting.
And we do have the two statues that I mentioned. They are either side of the sweeping staircase that takes us up to two of the exhibitions there. What can we say about these fellows, who I should mention are in recumbent posture? One of them looks fed up and is manacled. The other fellow looks like he's had one too many.
Yeah. So raving and melancholy madness are the two of the most iconic things that we have in our collection. They were originally above the gates of the hospital's second site at Moorfields in the city. They're all that survive of that building now. It was demolished and is now really where Moorgate Station is, that sort of area, Finsbury Circus. The statues were rescued after that hospital was demolished. It partly demolished, it partly fell down. and they were brought to the hospital's third site south of the river at St George's Fields. They did go temporarily on loan to both the Museum of London and the Victoria and Albert Museum, and then in 1970, when our own small museum opened, they came back to us there. We never had very much space to display them, so what's really wonderful about their new location is you can really step back and look at them, you can walk around the back of them, and it just really appreciate the sculptures.
We'll be talking a little bit more, I suspect, about the smallness of the previous museum and the very real need for a bigger place. When people, Richard, talk about hospitals in London, it often feels to me like they're talking about a psychogeography that I don't really have access to, if I'm being honest, and I don't know whether that's because it's hospital users or whether just a different way of using London means that you're more aware of these enormous establishments around town. Could you locate us here in the context of hospitals in town and how it fits into the London medical scene?
Sure. Bethnal Royal Hospital is part of South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust, which is one of eight mental health trusts in London. The trust itself has four inpatient sites around South London, and we provide services in South East London to about five different London boroughs, as well as national services. So people on the site will either be local people who might be coming from the local community for a sort of day service or staying as inpatients, and also national people. So we have some unique services here which are only available at this hospital site, so people can come from all around the country to access those services.
And it specialises, as you say, in mental health?
Yes, purely a psychiatric hospital.
There's something quite interesting that I was reading about that, which is the focus of the hospital on good mental health as opposed to, first and foremost, fixing mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent that was always the case, because Bethlehem's a very old hospital and the current treatments we have for mental ill health are all quite recent 20th century developments. So in earlier years, Bethlehem had a real focus on sort of decent food and a little light gardening and fresh air and actually promoting good mental health rather than trying to resolve some sort of difficulty. And I think that that's the case, you know, both for people working at the hospital now. There's a real emphasis on promoting good mental health and well-being, and I think it's got to be the way forward, really, you know, sort of prevention rather than cure. So it is something that South London and Maudsley are very, very interested in.
How does that work, though? Because it seems to me that if somebody comes to you, then it's already presumably a condition that they've noticed, there's something going wrong, so you're almost past that point already. Sure. Is there a lot of outreach that goes on?
From the hospital point of view, I mean, I think the website has an emphasis on the five ways to well-being, which I think has now been renamed the Wheel of Wellbeing, because I think there's probably more than five things identified now. But those sort of ideas which the original hospital would have recognised, saying, you know, go out and have a walk, engage with the open space, that sort of thing. The museum certainly has taken those on board. The Maudsley Charity, which has funded the museum, also funds something called the Recovery College, and there again the idea is very much offering classes in well-being and improving your mental health rather than, you know, just having to end up in hospital or at your GP surgery when something goes wrong. So I think, you know, there's a limit to what all hospitals can do, because they're all set up to, you know, mend things when they're broken, but I think it's definitely a step in the right direction, I think.
That's interesting. Is it your impression that individually and maybe societally, maybe from the top down, we take enough preemptive care of our mental health?
I don't think people do, because actually it's that sort of, there's still that sort of embarrassment in even talking about it. And it does seem to be that mental health is talked about more on the news and that sort of thing. But actually, with your physical health, people go to the gym and they keep fit and, you know, hopefully they eat a reasonable amount, and there's a lot of public health information out there about not drinking too much and, you know, not eating too much salt and not eating too much sugar. I don't think that there is that kind of preemptive, people don't talk about it as much with mental health somehow, you know, and I think it could be done a lot more, and I think we're people are starting to talk about it more, and that's the way forward. But there's this sort of squeamishness, a bit of embarrassment about talking about it, you know, so I can't imagine that someone would say, oh, do you know, I'm starting to feel a bit, it's all getting a bit much, I think I'll go and book in for some counselling. You know, they might do it. I don't know that they'd be really open and positive about doing it. They might be, you know, seeing it with some sort of sense of failure. It's personal view, but it doesn't seem that people are as open as talking about it.
Well, and it's one of those things, I suspect, as well, like insurance, where you only realise the need for it at the point at which it becomes pressing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think there is that sort of emphasis, and people are sort of, you know, geared up to cope and crack on and, you know, not accept that actually they need to look after themselves and put themselves first. You know, I think most people are so busy sort of, you know, working and doing what they need to do and just sort of concentrating on the basics of survival that actually the things that would help you to build up resilience are maybe seen as a bit of a luxury, you know, so having that long bath and just sort of chilling out, you know, seen as a bit of an indulgence, and you should be, you know, learning French or doing something more practical. So I think there's that aspect as well, that we're just not very good at giving ourselves time, actually. Whereas I guess if you're going to the gym for 2 hours and, you know, getting your heart rate going, then that's seen as a, you know, productive use of time.
We are going to be heading upstairs shortly to look at art, but some of the street names around here are intriguing in themselves, and it really prompts me to think a little bit about the history of the music. Richard is pointing at Victoria. He does not want to talk about the history of the music.
I hope she knows more than I do.
Well, we're on, it's Monk's Orchard, Monk's Orchard Road.
Yes, absolutely. So traditionally people have assumed that this was the site of a monastery or something like that. It was actually the name of a local family. The monks were a local family. It was never a sort of religious foundation on this site. The site that we're on is over 200 acres. It's a sort of huge piece of green, really, in the middle of South London, on the edges of South London, and it was part of a larger local estate, the Langley Estate. It became an independent estate in the late 18th, early 19th century.
Is that the colonnaded building we see on the website?
No, that's an earlier Bethlehem site, but there is, when you come to this site from the Croydon end, rather than the Eden Park station, the way you've come, you do see two little lodge buildings. So one of them is very sort of mock Tudor, it's quite a sort of strange building in the middle of the suburbs, and there's another little Georgian lodge which is at the far at the other end of Monk's Orchard Road. So there are echoes of the original estate that was here, where you look for them. There's also a Cheston Avenue nearby, and Cheston was the hospital surveyor who did some of the design for the site. He sadly died just after it was completed, so his name was, you know, commemorated in one of the local streets.
What about Eden Park itself?
Eden Park. I don't know a huge amount about Eden Park.
So many religious overtones.
Yeah, it's sort of quite a wonderful name. The hospital's chaplain, who was a chap called O'Donoghue, who I don't know how much religious work he did, really, because he edited the hospital's in-house magazine and he took the time to write a history of Bethlehem. And, you know, I don't know how much actual work he did other than that. He seemed to have a lot of time on his hands. But he came and paid a visit down to the site before the hospital had actually officially bought it, and he kind of broke into the house and had a good sort of look around. I mean, it wasn't occupied, obviously, but he sort of writes in the hospital magazine that this is going to be a sort of a new Eden for our Adams and Eves in the hospital, you know, and he really sort of picked up on that religious reference. But where it came from originally, I'm not sure. Any local historians out there will probably be shouting at the radio as we speak.
It seems as though, I guess you must have spent a little bit of time in his company reading his work. It sounds as though you've got quite an image of what this fellow was like.
Well, we've got the most wonderful photograph of him. As you walk from Eden Park Station to the hospital, behind the fence there's quite a lot of ferns, and there's a wonderful photograph of O'Donoghue literally up to the bottom of his beard in ferns when he came to visit. His wife must have taken the photograph, I think. And so yes, I have this sort of vision of this sort of bearded man and surrounded by ferns, really. I'm sure there's other photographs of him, but that's the one that I remember. And it just quite appealed to me, this sort of idea that they came down on the train for a good nose, actually, so they could go back to the people at the hospital and go, well, you know, this is what they've got planned, and look, here's photos of the farm. And he was very excited about the countryside aspect, because when they moved to St George's Fields, it was fields. By the early 20th century, when he was the chaplain at the hospital, it was, you know, Southwark Lambeth borders, very built up, very busy. So he writes in the magazine about seeing real cows and, you know, real trees, and you think, as opposed to, you know.
Which is exactly how I started this podcast, yeah. In fact. And it does seem that some of the buildings, the domestic buildings, as you come down here, look as though they belong to a much more villagey lifestyle. It seems like the busyness on the roads is somehow out of place.
Yes, I think so. I mean, when the hospital purchased the Monk's Orchard Estate, it was part of a larger estate that had been sold off, and all the lots had gone apart from lot one, which was the house and the home farm and the gardens, which is what the hospital now occupies. So there were various cottages and sort of small holdings and pubs and that sort of thing included in the estate when it was first sold. A lot of the housing around here is from 1920s, 1930s, and, you know, dates from about the same time as the hospital or shortly afterwards. So I would imagine it was, you know, a pretty rural place.
Richard, on the historical side of things, I'm guessing there must be some nuggets of information about the hospital or some particularly twinkly facts that have caught your eye in the course of your work.
I think I was talking the other day about how when they constructing this site, they built a mini railway around it, because it was over sort of, like say, over 250 acres. So to move the building material around, they built this mini light railway. And we've got some fascinating pictures of that as well. So it's really interesting.
And when did that disappear? Because I know the first thing any Londonist listener will want to know is how can we get on that railway?
It never made it on the tube map either. I think it was pretty much deconstructed as the buildings were constructed. But I think sort of the nature of this site, it wasn't built as a traditional hospital asylum. It was built in what's called a villa style. So all of the walls around the site are basically in standalone buildings with their own grounds around them. So it's quite spread out, really.
I've got one question that's very specific to you and one question that is in no way specific to you. One that's just, if it's okay, I'm taking a complete aside from everything here. I've never understood with some of the London hospitals why they're named after one area but appear in a different area. Do you happen to know what that's all about?
That's a very good question. I mean, Victoria's probably more educated in terms of the origins of Bethlehem Royal Hospital, but my kind of basic understanding of it is it was a sort of an adaptation of Bethlehem, and the word has sort of changed.
I didn't have here in mind in particular. I think I'm right in saying that, for example, Charing Cross Hospital is in Hammersmith or something like that. Yeah. Or there's one or two weird anomalies like that.
I assume it's a similar kind of thing where they've moved from their original locations.
That was as straightforward as that.
Time. I think it's sort of space and fresh air, and I suppose also if the hospitals own the land and they're able to sell land in central London and move slightly further out, it makes some money. I suspect also the coming of the railway had an impact as well. I think probably things have had to move over the years when the railways have come in, so whether Charing Cross Hospital was sort of in the way of development. I think usually it's, you know, they're trying to get more space, and, you know, and of course the idea of sort of fresh air and open space is central to both, you know, sort of physical health and, you know, mental health. So you'd get sort of things like fever hospitals would always want to be in places like Hampstead, you know, where you had fresh air and hills and that sort of thing. So I suspect it's to do with London becoming overcrowded and hospitals seeking more space.
That's really obvious as soon as one starts to think about it. Of course, yeah, that would be the reason. No. The very specific question. As the media officer, senior communications and media officer, what sort of thing do you find yourself dealing with in respect of the four hospitals that you're involved with?
A whole mix of things, really. I mean, a lot of our work at the moment really concentrates on trying to destigmatise mental health. So we do a lot of work now on things like social media. We've got a kind of really great following now. We've got sort of top 15 Twitter accounts in the NHS, which doesn't sound that exciting, but in terms of healthcare, it's pretty good stuff. We've got, you know, nearly 9,000 followers on Twitter, so we're trying to regularly interact with people. There's a whole range of people there, from, you know, patients to healthcare professionals, interested members of the public. So we do quite a lot of work around social media interaction. So we do tweet chats, for example. So we might get kind of one of our specialists in a certain area to come in and talk for an hour on a key subject. So there's quite a lot of work around stigma, a lot of just kind of general communication, working with our local communities. They're the kind of key things, really.
In terms of that stigmatisation, I can understand, for example, that if your colleagues thought you've got a mental health problem and they didn't like the sound of that too much, you could be forced into a position, or people turning their backs on you, or whatever it might be. In terms of the individual who might be suffering from poor mental health, what's that destigmatisation about? How does that work?
I think it's really about kind of supporting them to actually kind of have a network of people out there that are sort of going through the same things as them, and other healthcare professionals helping to help to find kind of techniques and support, really.
Is that on sort of illness by illness, or is it the case that, because I find it hard to believe that people don't know that mental health is a thing, so is it like nobody else has got this particular set of circumstances?
I think you get kind of sort of general people may fall into general groups and experience similar kind of problems, and then I think that's where you see people coming together and looking for support, really. So
Well, we're going to head between two atypical examples, I suspect, of mental health conditions. And we're going to head upstairs between melancholy and raving. It's not just raving, it's raving...
Well, they're raving and melancholy madness is what they're known as. I don't know if they were ever formally titled, but that's what we know them as.
Does anyone still use the word madness in any respect?
Well, colloquially, I think they do. But I think, I think it's been reclaimed a bit. I mean, people just sort of say, oh, that's mad, in a really sort of positive way, I think. So I think it's quite a... I don't know if people use it in a mental health context. It's maybe not...
patient notes anymore.
Let's head upstairs.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm Ian Quentin Wolfe, and we're at the Bethlehem Hospital, Southeast London, with me, Richard Morley, and Victoria Northwood, and I am in love with a clock. This is a fantastic object.
I'm really glad you are, because the architect was dying to pull it off the wall.
No!
And get rid of it, and I said, no, it's lovely. So I'm glad you like it.
This is like a brass starburst.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if it's a 1931 original to the building or whether it's later, but I just quite liked it, really, so I'm glad you like it as well.
Quite so. It goes very well with the oak doors and the lion doorknobs and the marble here. It's got a very 1930s feel to it. We're about to head into the permanent exhibition, I think.
Yes, so this is the first of our two exhibition spaces. It's being designed and fitted out by Real Studios, who recently did the David Bowie exhibition at the V&A. So we've got...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Bona fide designers in here helping us out with this. We've been very lucky. We've received some Heritage Lottery funding in order to be able to do this. There's no way we would have been able to afford it otherwise. So what you'll see as we go in is still very much a work in progress. But the idea is that we'll be combining different aspects of our collections. So there'll be works of art, there'll be historic objects, there'll be archive material. But there'll also be some material that's been created specially for the exhibition. So we've been filming people. We've been taking photographs, so you'll see some sort of contemporary stuff as well going on in there. We're aiming not to tell the history of Bethlehem from 1247 to the present day, because that would not be everyone's cup of tea, I suspect.
Why ever not?
Well, we're going to have a chronology, so people who do want to trace the history in that way, this area that we're standing at the moment will have key dates. dates and some photographs shown so that people can locate themselves in the history and work out where they are. But the exhibition will be a lot more thematic. So the idea is we're looking at different themes, which you'll see flagged up as we go in, and each theme will contain both contemporary and historical material, because most of the themes we're looking at have a historical and a contemporary resonance.
I feel compelled to ask, what was here in 1247?
Oh my goodness, I should think just fields and farms and things. So Bethlehem Hospital itself in 1247 would have been a small priory. It was roughly where Liverpool Street Station's located now, on Bishopsgate, and it was a sort of small priory. We don't know a huge amount about the building. It appears on a map that the Museum of London have in their collection, but we don't know a huge amount about it, and actually the archives dating from that period are in the National Archives. We don't have them. So it's a bit of a, you know, sort of mysterious, hazy period of time for us. We know a little more about the subsequent buildings and what went on in the hospital then.
Well, we drop the chronology and we go to themes. Let's head into the exhibition. I'm reminded, listener, of my first visit to the Tate Modern, where one of the areas was designed to look like a gallery being put together, complete with tools lying around, but was in fact itself a work of art. Here the installation includes actors who've been employed to play builders, and they're up ladders pretending to install things.
Yes, no, this is unfortunately definitely still a work in progress, not the finished article. So the stage we're at the moment, we've got most of the graphics up on the walls. There are still some display cases being built at the moment. There's some more glass sitting around because some of our paintings aren't glazed, so we will have sort of protection in front of them. So, yeah, there's still quite a lot of work going on.
All of which might well be done by the time this goes out, which I think is going to be probably in February.
Yes, that's
your opening time, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So we're due to open to the public in mid-February, coinciding with spring half-term week for those people with children. So, yes, by then, all things being equal, everything will be complete and shipshape.
Could you give us a bit of an example of what we might experience here, a taster?
Okay, so when you first step into the exhibition, you'll recognise Raving and Melancholy. We've used an engraving of the two statues as a sort of design feature, really, which comes up throughout the museum. The statues are very important to us. There was no way we were going to get them up the staircase. They're Portland stone, incredibly heavy, so they were never going to be upstairs in the exhibition, but it means that they still join us up here, which I think is very important. The exhibition has a number of different themes. So the first one is visiting Bethlehem, and the reason we start with that is that of all the things people know or think they know about Bethlehem is that you used to be able to pay to come and laugh at the mad people. It was actually, the unrestricted visiting was a really short period of time in Bethlehem.
And a PR disaster.
Yeah, well, yes, in a number of ways. So when there was unrestricted visiting, you see this picked up in Hogarth's engraving of the Rake's Progress. You know, there's this sort of the people all around and the ladies with their fans sort of walking around observing. There's also a lot of written accounts of that period of time, and it was in London tourist guides of the day. So, you know, one of the things you were recommended to do was go and see the lunatics at Bedlam. You know, it was on the tourist trail in the 18th century. But it actually stopped in 1770. They ended this practice because they realised that people weren't necessarily coming to be educated or enlightened.
After it had gone on for how long?
I think it's certainly sort of, you know, 30, 40 years. So a reasonable, you know, quite a period of time, just in the length of the history. It's a relatively short period. But yeah, the idea had been that you could visit Bethlehem, you could learn from it, and also it was a charity, so they needed charitable donations. And the idea was people would look around the hospital and say, gosh, isn't it doing marvellous work? I'll give a donation. Of course, what really happened was people had a few too many. They met up with their mates at the hospital. There were lots of dark corners. There's lots of people acting in possibly irrational ways. So a bit of bad behaviour might go unnoticed. And it was a bit of a free-for-all. So after 1770, you could only visit the hospital if you had a formal introduction and you had an admission ticket and it was all formalised. Now, the problem with that, of course, is if you haven't got anyone just dropping in on the off chance, you get to that sort of Ofsted inspection a frame of mind where everything's made very nice and shiny for when there's a formal visit, and then everything sort of slips a bit. So in 1815, there ended up being a parliamentary inquiry into the state of Bethlehem. There was, a real sort of uproar about the state of things because, you know, that was the sort of unintended consequence, really, of stopping that unrestricted visiting. So, it's an interesting idea, and it's one we're starting with because that's the one thing everyone thinks they know about the hospital. So
it seems as though there might still be obviously not resonances of that sort, but there might be challenges inherent in running a museum and attracting people in the midst of a working hospital.
I mean, what's interesting is when we have group visits to the hospital, we'll talk about the history, and we sort of talk about this period where people could come and, you know, sort of come and look at the mad people, and, you know, all the people in the audience will sit there going, oh, that's really barbaric, that's terrible. And then in the next step, they will say, so can we see on one of the wards? And you think, you know, actually, no, you can't. We've kind of got away from that.
Let me ask you, what do you think of then? There are one or two authors who come to mind who've written books that sort of profile different, really extreme mental health conditions, mm-hmm. and anatomise them. And sort of put them out as, I don't think it's entirely instructional. I think there's an element of diversion going on there as well. How does that fit into the sort of landscape that we're talking about for you?
So, I mean, I think it's really important for us that this is a working hospital, and that many of our visitors are going to be patients in the hospital now, or people who've got relatives who are unwell, or, you know, people in the community who are unwell. So we do have to be quite mindful. It's important not to sensationalise anything, and to be very straightforward in the way we talk about things, but equally we don't want to hide things. So for instance, we will be displaying 18th century manacles, we will be displaying straitjackets, because if we don't display those things, we're going to be accused of whitewashing the history of mental health care, and that's something we don't want to do either. So it is quite a sort of quite a tightrope we're walking, really. We're hoping to incorporate into this exhibition some sort of factual information about various mental health conditions, not on the walls necessarily, but there'll be various interactive points where you can access, for instance, some information that the Royal College of Psychiatrists publish about different diagnoses. So we're hoping that the information people access will be reliable and straightforward and not too sensational.
A friend of mine is going through an experience where both of his parents at the same time have dementia, and he said to me that one of the things he didn't realise and that nobody ever mentions is just how funny it can be at times. He mentioned his father coming into the room and announcing that he was a pokaloo, and then leaving the room and then coming back a moment later and going, but what's a pokaloo? So I guess there are different shades to it, but
yeah. I think in our sort of historical material, you find these sort of slightly humorous moments. Also, I mean, I think it is one of those inescapable things. I mean, an example that comes to mind is there was a very famous 19th and late 19th, early 20th century artist called Louis Wain, who was best known for doing cats. He was, you know, famous commercial artist, very well known in his day. But he wasn't a terribly good businessman, and he ended up becoming unwell in later life, and he was in Springfield Asylum in Tooting. And one of the hospital sort of visiting committee, or, you know, where they sort of walked around and inspected, walked around and looked over his shoulder and said, oh gosh, you know, you draw just like that man Louis Wain. And of course he said, but I am Louis Wain. Of course you are, dear, you know. So you do get these sort of, you know, these elements of humour really coming out throughout.
There were a couple of other artists as well, I think, of some renown who've passed through the doors here.
Yeah, so I mean, Richard Dadd is probably the most sort of publicly well-known figure. He was at Bethlehem for around 20 years. He had a very sort of distinguished early career, and then became unwell and murdered his father as a result of his illness. And he didn't go to trial. If he'd gone to trial, he wouldn't have gone to hospital. He would have been hung, because it was very much premeditated attack on his father. He'd taken a change of clothes and a passport, and, you know, he was acting in a very premeditated way. So when he was picked up in France, they just said, oh, he's far too unwell to stand trial, and he was sent to Bethlehem. So included in this exhibition, there will be a photograph of him working at Bethlehem on a painting called Contradiction, which is sadly not in our collection, but he continued to paint throughout his time at Bethlehem. And then when Broadmoor opened in the 1860s, he was transferred over to Broadmoor. And again, a lot of the art we have in the collection is on loan from Broadmoor Hospital, because he continued to create throughout his life. Although he was not free to go anywhere, he continued to have this amazing inner life and to paint and draw and create.
And because of our conversation earlier, I now understand immediately why Broadmoor is as far out in the sticks as it is.
Yes, well, you know, again, it was originally the State Criminal Lunatic Asylum was built in 1815, and it was actually tacked onto the back of Bethlehem Hospital. Bethlehem was just about to move to its new site south of the river at St George's Fields, which is a building that's now used as the Imperial War Museum. And the Home Office decided it would be very convenient to tack their new State Criminal Lunatic Asylum onto the back of the hospital. But it was very overcrowded, wasn't built particularly beautifully. Conditions were pretty poor, so actually Bethlehem ended up moving a lot of the criminal lunatics into their main wards to create space and just make things a bit more pleasant. So Broadmoor, by comparison, although it's starting to look a bit rickety around the edges now, I mean, when it opened, Broadmoor was, you know, an amazing, beautiful place compared to where these people had been held. And they also took the opportunity to review each case when they moved people across to Broadmoor, and there were a few people where they assessed them and said, actually, you know, you can probably go, it's probably fine. So the most famous of those would be Edward Oxford, who tried to assassinate Queen Victoria on Constitution Hill, and he was only 18, so his family and friends made a big point of saying that he wasn't quite right in the head, and, you know, he was very sort of behaving very irrationally, so he was sent to Bethlehem again, you know, as an alternative to being hung for his attempt on the Queen's life. But when he was due to be transferred to Broadmoor, they reassessed him and said, well, actually, if you'd like to emigrate under a different name, you do that. And he spent the rest of his life in Australia and wrote back to his doctors at Bethlehem to tell them how he was doing, which is how we know about his story.
That's remarkable. I need to dig further into that. But not now, because I suspect there's a lot of meat on that bone.
Podcast to be had on Edward Oxford,
exactly.
I think.
There's a question that's been just under the surface here that I haven't asked. But you've used the names Bethlehem and Bedlam almost interchangeably, it seemed, at points. What's that all about?
So when the hospital was founded, it was founded as the Priory of St Mary of Bethlehem. And, of course, nobody could be bothered to say that. It was a bit like the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust, you know, far too long. So quite quickly, it became known interchangeably as Bedlam or Bethlehem, just depending on how people wanted to shorten Bethlehem, really. Eventually, the name Bethlehem became a sort of the formally adopted name of the hospital. It was refounded by Henry VIII after the dissolution of the monasteries as one of the five royal hospitals of London, and became Bethlehem Royal Hospital at that point. So Bethlehem became the sort of formal name of the hospital. And I suppose Bedlam became the sort of the concept, really. So Bedlam is what appears in the Jacobean drama. You know, Bedlam is the idea of noise and disruption. And also, in the same way that Hoover became, you know, the generic name for a vacuum cleaner, you get Bedlam becoming the generic term for a psychiatric hospital. So, a particular city or area would build themselves a Bedlam.
But it seems also like Bedlam is the Mr. Hyde to the Bethlehem's Dr. Jekyll.
Yeah, could be. I mean, there's a sort of undertone of chaos, I suppose, isn't there?
We should look in the closing minutes at whatsoever you feel we should squeeze in.
Well, as well as the permanent exhibition, we have a temporary exhibition gallery as well, so we could go and look in there because we have some paintings up.
Well, the room we've just entered is a much brighter affair at this stage. A lot of downlighters and some contemporary art already on the walls. If I was one of the artists, I'd be quivering with nerves at the sight of all these buckets of paint mere inches from my painting.
So we're assured that they won't be painting anywhere near the art. So all the works in this area are by one artist, Brian Charnley, who's a late 20th century artist. Some of the works on display belong to us, and others have been lent by the artist's estate, which is just arrived this week. So this is, again, is still very much a work in progress. that we thought we would start with a show concentrating on one particular artist. We will do different things throughout the year. We're aiming to have about 4 exhibitions a year. So it'll be a great opportunity to show off work from our collection, but also work inspired by things in our collection. So Charnley was never a patient at Bethlehem or the Maudsley, but he was familiar with our art collection, and he was very inspired by a painting called The Maze, in which the artist depicts the inside of his head and all the different things that are going on. And you'll see some of Charnley's paintings are very obviously inspired by The Maze, and so we will be using this space to show work that's inspired by the collections as well as work from our collections.
And this looks like a function room if ever I saw one.
Oh, it could be good. It could be good. So the main reason for the other half of this room, which has no paintings in it at the moment, is that for a number of years we've had a very successful learning programme, schools, universities, and also, you know, general interest groups, lifelong learners, the term being the official one, I think. But we've never had our own space to actually deliver that. So this is the first time we will actually have had a room of our own, where we've got proper audiovisual equipment and, you know, sort of matching chairs and tables and that sort of thing, rather than constantly having to camp out in whatever room we can lay our hands on. So it's really going to revolutionise what we're able to do, both in terms of our learning programme and being able to open up to more schools and colleges, but also, you know, being able to do an events programme, you know, film screenings, talks, that sort of thing as well. So we're really excited about this space.
As the person in charge of managing the public profile of the place, Richard, of course the redevelopment is a wonderful thing, no question about that. Surely this must be, compared with the museum as was, that was sort of deliberately under the radar because it was kind of too tiny to take on too many visitors, this must represent a spike in your workload.
I think it's a fantastic opportunity for us. As I said, really, a lot of the work we're doing is around reducing stigma and really trying to encourage the local community to come in and see what we do and not be afraid of it or fearful.
What have you got on your plate in terms of making that happen?
We're doing lots of work at the moment in terms of press releases and working with the media and trying to really kind of, you know, drum up some real buzz around the opening of the museum. And we're working a lot with the local community, our residents' associations and other people to try and encourage people to come in.
On which point perhaps it'd be useful to give sort of clear directions of how to get here, because it is a little bit out of the way. Eden Park's a good bet if you come in on the train, and then it's a pleasant walk down here.
It definitely is. You can get a direct train from London Bridge, Charing Cross or Cannon Street to Eden Park, and then you can take the 356 bus or a short 10-minute walk from the station to the hospital following Monk's Orchard Road.
I've heard about this hospital bus, though. I don't know if this is something open to the general public.
I'm afraid it's not.
I was told that that might be a podcast in itself.
Oh, it definitely is.
What goes on in the hospital bus?
Oh, everything you can imagine.
It's actually it's yeah. it's a half hour journey from Bethlehem to the Maudsley, and actually it's a really nice little dozing time or a half hour podcast, in fact.
Yeah, I was actually catching up on your most recent podcast on the way here.
So that's what goes on the bus. Me,
no eating or drinking either.
Well, good luck. Of course, by the time this goes out, it will all have been a fantastic success, and there'll be people piling through the doors, exhibitions open, workmen vermoosed. The very best of luck for that.
Thank you.
Should we mention the website just finally?
Yeah, so the museum's website, and we have sort of good directions of how to get here on the website as well, if you didn't catch that, maps and everything. We are museumofthemind.org.uk.
Victoria Northwood, Richard Morley, thanks very much.
Thank you. My heart aches for some far
off days, no one could have left. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Victoria Northwood and Richard Morley. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm Ian Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.